What I'd like to delve into a little deeper today is I'd like to continue a little farther about what I, last week I mentioned a sutta called the Bahya Sutta. And I just sort of brought it up in a manner of like, well, you've all heard of that, right? Like, you, of course you would know the Bahya Sutta and that famous passage out of it, right? And then later on, I'm like, wait a minute, maybe I better not assume that, you know, maybe I better... Why don't we just kind of go over that just quickly, or at least kind of the real key passage. So there is a, I'll paste a couple links before we part ways tonight, to these suttas. Now, there is a free online translation of this sutta done by Ajahn Tenisaro, Tenisaro Bhikkhu. And this is in the Udana ones, Udana 1.10, 10th Sutta. Okay, so the Buddha is giving this super brief instruction to Bahya, and then Bahya attains enlightenment like on the spot after hearing basically one paragraph. So that's, you know, this paragraph has captured a whole lot of attention, because wouldn't it be nice if we could attain Nibbana too, you know, from hearing one paragraph. Okay, so here's that paragraph. Okay, then Bahya, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard, like that which you hear. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you, there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahya, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here, nor yonder, nor in between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress. Or that's what Ajahn Tenisaro says, stress or suffering, as other translators would say. Okay, and then the next paragraph. Through hearing this brief explanation of the Dhamma from the Blessed One, the mind of Bahya of the bark cloth, right then and there, was released from effluence through lack of clinging sustenance. Anyway, yeah, so he attained Nibbana. That's kind of a nice way to say that. So anyway, so this is kind of an enigmatic paragraph. Like, how do we unpack that? You know, what is this? You know, it's the kind of paragraph you might read several times and maybe not know quite how to, like, interpret that or how to apply that. You know, it's kind of mysterious, you know, kind of esoteric. So now there is another far less mentioned, far less taught sutta I kind of stumbled across, which has a similar pattern to it, but it expands it more. It's as though we just took that kind of mysterious boiled down paragraph and then kind of like unpack that into, you know, a few paragraphs, like a four-ish paragraphs. So you know, this greatly interested me. And there is a where I came across this is in a free for distribution Dhamma book, whose title was Magic of the Mind. So this was a book done in English by an ethnic Sri Lankan monk who knew English. And his name is, the name on the cover is K. Nyanananda, like Bhante K. Nyanananda, like K initial. His name's hard to say. Nyanananda. Okay. Nyanananda. And when we expand the K, that's the village he's from. He's Katu Kurunde Nyanananda. Okay? Not to be confused with this other K. Nyanananda, who's also famous in Sri Lanka, who is Kiribat Goda Nyanananda. There's another village, Kiribat Goda. Kiribat Goda means milk rice, by the way, which is like pretty much the favorite dish of a lot of Sri Lankans, and is in the suttas. All right, so this K. Nyanananda did a translation specially of this one sutta called Just give me one second. The Kalakarama Sutta. So the this book Magic of the Mind sort of delves into this sutta, and then this Sri Lankan monk gives his own sort of Dhamma talk around that sutta. But the actual sutta has this boiled down awesome part. So I'm going to read this, and it's going to kind of sound familiar, okay? Compared to the last one. Okay, so the Buddha is explaining what it is like to be enlightened here, and this is a rare explanation. This is a very kind of precious glimpse, a rare glimpse into kind of how his mind works as an arhat. Like, he's kind of describing this rather hard to describe state he's in as an arhat now. Okay, so all right, and the Buddha refers to himself as the Tathagata in the suttas. Okay, it means something like the one thus gone, or the one who is such, that kind of thing. It is kind of an enigmatic title he calls himself. Like, you know, this arhant right here is what he is kind of referring to himself, like the one thus gone. Okay, so here he says, "Thus, monks, a Tathagata does not conceive of a visible thing as apart from sight. He does not conceive of an unseen. He does not conceive of a thing worth seeing. He does not conceive about a seer," as in like one who sees. "He does not conceive of an audible thing as apart from hearing. He does not conceive of an unheard. He does not conceive of a thing worth hearing. He does not conceive about a hearer. He does not conceive of a thing to be sensed as apart from sensation. He does not conceive of an unsensed. He does not conceive of a thing worth sensing. He does not conceive about one who senses. He does not conceive of a cognizable thing as apart from cognition. He does not conceive of an uncognized. He does not conceive of a thing worth cognizing. He does not conceive about one who cognizes. Thus, monks, the Tathagata, being such like in regard to all phenomena, seen, heard, sensed, and cognized, is such. Moreover, than he who is such, there is none other greater or more excellent, I declare." Okay, so to me, this is one of my very, very favorite suttas. Okay, this is, I don't know, like, this just gives me such a boost of inspiration when I read this, because to me, this actually kind of paints a picture of what I'm supposed to be doing and where it is I'm eventually heading, as it were, as a monk, you know, like I'm sure we're all quite aware of, you know, there's all sorts of teachers out there of various types of meditation and various sorts of practices of mindfulness, and they can be totally secular, you know, just mindfulness kind of minus the Buddhism kind of thing, or Buddhism doesn't really get mentioned, or, you know, like teachings like this are 100 miles away from something they'd ever mention, you know. So how can I put it? To me, it is a little, well, maybe just a little bit frustrating as a monk when these teachers are teaching some kind of meditation training or mindfulness training. And I'm sure they're well-intentioned. I'm not calling them bad people or anything. And, you know, there's a lot of other far worse things they could be doing for a living that I'm glad they're not doing. But how can I put this? If all they teach is mindfulness, you know, that indeed will improve one's life somewhat. There will certainly be some noticeable gains and some, you know, it's good to do that. But mindfulness, just doing that much and not more, there's so much more to Buddhism. There's so much more, you know, yet to be done. And and to me, this Kalakarama really, to me anyway, gives me something to aim for that I am eventually trying to learn and be in that mode, you know, kind of all the time. That would be great. So and this is a really hard hitting sutta too. This is a really, how can I put it? Perhaps the reason this sutta is not really taught very much, or a lot of people have never heard this one before. Like, this is a hard hitting sutta. This is actually a very this sutta packs a punch in the sense that a lot of people might not really want to hear it if it challenges, shall we say, some dearly held values they have or deeply held beliefs they have, which they're maybe not ready to let go of or second guess or whatever, right? Like, you know, like, for example, okay, I'll just give you a really simple kind of example. Is like, I have a sister out in Nova Scotia. She lives in Halifax. And, you know, I wouldn't really call her a Buddhist, but, you know, we still get along well, and she has kids and stuff. And you know, just like any good mother, pretty much every time I talk to her, that's the topic on her mind, is those kids, and she likes to talk about them and show pictures. And okay, yes, they're cute, and yes, you know, that's all well and good. You know, but then along comes a teaching like this, which maybe she wouldn't like to hear, where it's the kind of thing like, you know, the Tathagata does not conceive of a thing worth seeing. Like, there is no, in comparison to Nibbana, he would gladly give up ever laying eyes on my nieces. You know what I mean? Like, he would far prefer Nibbana to the sight of even his own nieces. You know, so that's kind of my point here, is when we go down this rabbit hole of Buddhism kind of all the way, you know, yes, we, as Buddhists, would all agree, okay, yeah, being an arhat would be awesome. That would be the best. That would be the highest accomplishment, the highest achievement. You know, that's the ideal. That's what the religion is sort of centered around, is Nibbana and arhatship. And it kind of ripples out from there, right? But are we ready to, shall we say, challenge some of our kind of perspectives, you know, in ways that might not quite be so comfortable? You know, like, every arhant has to come to terms with, you know, if or at least what I should say is, if we would like to be an arhant, this is the kind of thing we have to come to terms with, is that, well, but there are no sights that you need to feel that they are essential in your life anymore. Because once you attain Nibbana, they aren't going to be around anymore. And that's the end of it. Like, you know, so are you willing to let go of all that, right? You know, like, of course, many teachers will say things like, oh, yes, we need to let go. We need to overcome our clinging and our attachment. Okay, well, that's less threatening to phrase it that way. Okay, that's a skillful teaching, yeah, you know, but when you read the suttas directly, you oftentimes come across this sort of thing, which, like, the Buddha just cranks up the potency several notches, you know, especially when he's teaching Buddhist monks, right? Like this, you know, I should qualify this saying, like, the Buddha's teaching his monks in this sutta. He's not teaching lay people. So, you know, I'm going to apologize if this is maybe not the greatest choice of teaching for this audience, although you've all meditated quite a bit, you know, you've all got some background here. So, you know, it's not like you're all of you are just completely fresh off the turnip wagon to Buddhism here. You know, you've done some meditating, and I praise you for that. So, yeah, anyway, I guess I just want to, voice my appreciation for the Buddha, kind of not holding back about this sort of thing. You know, it's like, and to me, it's very positive. Like this is in reference to Nibbana, right? We're, you know what I mean? Like the Buddha is not coming out and saying, oh, you people, you've all got ugly children and I don't want to see them anymore. You know, he's not saying this, right? But what he's saying is, like, in comparison to Nibbana, there is nothing in this world worth seeing anymore. No worldly sights of any kind, whether it's, you know, this, that, or the other sorts of people at all, you know? So that's really heavy. That's like, you know, this a teaching like this can take years and even decades to, shall we say, digest, right? This is heavy, you know, because of course we all like the idea of Nibbana, no doubt, but when it is to the exclusion of things that we really like, you know, then it can challenge us. It can challenge us on a kind of a deeper, you know, it can draw us out of our comfort zone. You know, that's kind of my point here is, that's the kind of teacher that the Buddha can be. You know, there are all sorts of places and times where he is extremely diplomatic and extremely careful about how he speaks to whom. By the way, I wish I was that diplomatic myself. That'd be great. I'm working on it. but sometimes there are these deeper teachings in the suttas and like, how can I put it? Sometimes I maybe just feel a little frustrated that, like, why is nobody mentioning these more? They're so awesome. They're so, they're genius. Like, they're just, you know, you have to be a completely outstanding, ultra-rare genius to even utter this stuff. Like, you know, like someone like Einstein can invent E equals MC squared, and it would challenge, that would sure challenge the Christians, because now all of a sudden the Christian God is not the focal thing in the middle of how the universe works. It's like, no, energy just converts to matter and back, and God didn't have anything to do with that. You know, like Einstein had something really uncomfortable to say, you know, but he is praised now, and he is a hero now, and you know, we were willing, at least as Westerners, we were willing to take that on board, and it's not a threatening statement, you know what I mean? It's not, if we saw E equals MC squared written on the chalkboard, that would not threaten us, you know, so I guess maybe I'm just optimistic, you know, that these sorts of teachings of the Buddha, too, in time will kind of gain more prominence and gain more, maybe just a little more acceptance to a wider audience. You know what I mean? Like, maybe, you know, there's a lot of people who are kind of gradually warming up to, you know, meditation and mindfulness practice and different forms of meditation. And, you know, hopefully they will gradually kind of find their way to these more kind of deeper, more potent teachings, the more kind of hard hitting ones. Like there's, by the way, a little side tangent, this Kala Karama Sutta is, I'll leave a link at the end of the show, but, it's in the Anguttara Nikaya 4's, Sutta 24. And the Anguttara Nikaya, in my opinion, is one of the, most hard-hitting of the Nikayas, like of the Pali Canon. Like if you asked me, like, Venerable Subro, where can I find the most hard-hitting stuff of Buddhism? Like, give me the straight dope. Like, just, you know, I can take it. I'll be like the Anguttara Nikaya and the Samyutta Nikaya, a very close second place. Those two are the, how can I put it? Those are the, have the most potent stuff in them, in my opinion, which, and when I say that, I mean, like, it is less for lay people. It is more for monks, and it is for people who, you know, are supposed to have renounced the world entirely, you know, for people who are willing to face up to, you know, it's very hard to do that. It's very hard to be, to kind of put it all on the line, as it were, and you know, be willing to give it all up. So yeah, it's very, very hard to do. Yeah. So anyway, this to me is the most inspiring part, you know, of the Pali Canon. That'd be the Anguttara and the Samyutta. And it is in the Anguttara where we tend to find these such hard-hitting suttas. There's all sorts, you know, like if we actually spent some time, you know, I could list, you know, 40 like super hard-hitting suttas. It would not be hard to find. I could find you 100. Like, it wouldn't, you know, it's they're laying all over the place, you know. So okay. Now so it's 8:40 and I think this goes till 9. So I better open it up to some questions here.